Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour editorial review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and editorial review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on oxymorons when we come back. You know, those who already walk submissively will say that there's no cause for alarm, but submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage, and the Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people. The Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press, of political and social activities, free from government surveillance. Now, you know, I wish I'd have thought of that, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. And our princes and politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control, but you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years, have we? Now, that's why I contend that the only reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts. It doesn't come from our political process. It doesn't come from our politicians or lawyers or bureaucrats. Old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair, I think, when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, I'd like to echo that by saying, you give me the judicial power and I care not who makes the laws either, because the real power in America is in our courts, not in our politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into this power of the courts, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and then, best of all, it's free. And that number, again, is 417-273-4967. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure, our school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to your website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Then just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we've been talking about oxymorons. They're kind of fun, and they're kind of funny. Every once in a while, my daughter will come up with an oxymoron, you know, something, you know, like military intelligence, you know, that's one that's pretty old and been around for a long time. Well, there's another oxymoron that I've observed, and it's, "Hello, I'm from the government, and I want to help." Hello, I'm from the government, and I want to help. Now, an oxymoron is has a definition in the dictionary. An oxymoron comes from two words. It's O-X-Y-S, that's oxy, which means sharp, plus moros, M-O-R-O-S, which means foolish. And then we have an oxymoron here. That guy isn't the sharpest marble in the drawer. Sharpest marble in the drawer. It's a combination for epigrammic effect of contradictory or incongruous words, such as cruel kindness. Sharpest marble in the drawer. That's an oxymoron. It's the opposite to reason, logic, or common sense. But it's something that we all practice and that we all hold to. Like, "Hello, I'm from the government, and I want to help." We've talked about drunk drivers kill, and Social Security is the third rail of politics, and if you don't get a college degree, you're going to freeze in the dark. Is it really true that government can solve all of our problems? Because anytime there's a problem, I don't care what it is, somebody says, "Oh, we've got to take that to the city council. We've got to take that to our representative. We've got to call our congressman." I don't care what it is. You got a problem in your school? You have a problem with your car? You have a problem with, you know, we got a problem in this country with health care. And the other day, you know, it isn't just the other day, but the other day, you know, I was watching TV, and the McNeil-Lehrer reports, and about every once in a while, I mean, once a month, maybe twice a month, they'll have an article, they'll have a story on there about 44 million Americans don't have health care. Congress has just enacted a health care provision to ensure little kids don't have health care, and so on down the line. And so there's a great debate here in the United States about providing health care for all Americans, or to make health care available to all Americans, or to make health care affordable for all Americans. I don't want any health care. So if you're a politician and you're sitting out there figuring out how you can get health care and insurance, health insurance for George Gordon, would you stop? Don't do it for me. Now, there's about 300 million of us here in this country, and I'm just, you know, just one guy over here. So I suppose that for the other 299,999,999 people, they probably all need health care. I don't deny that. I don't know what they need. I just know that I don't need it, and I don't want it, and I don't want to pay for it. I don't want health care. I got to thinking the other day, I said, geez, if the government comes along and they want to provide health care for everybody, that's real nice of them. And I wanted to know, well, where did they get the money to do that? And I got to thinking, I says, well, how much money does government have? How much wealth does the government have? Where does the government's wealth come from? Does the government of the United States have a gold mine out in Nevada someplace where when they want $1 billion, they just get on the telephone and say, hey, dig up another $1 billion? Well, it is true. They've got some printing presses, and they print money, and they print bonds, and they do all these great and wondrous things here, you know, to finance government and debt and one thing and another. But I got to thinking about that, and I said, you know, the government doesn't have any money at all. Did you know that? Not a dime. The United States government doesn't have 10 cents. Don't have any wealth at all. They're so buried in debt that they couldn't pay it off if their lives depended on it. There's no way in hell they could pay that off. Now, I'm an old-timey guy, and we used to figure that wealth, money, came from people that actually had it. You know, like old Frank Rocha, you know, he had about $250,000 up in the Bank of Lolita that he had saved over a long period of time and actually had it in the bank, you know. He milked cows, and then he took the milk and he sold it to the creamery, and then he paid all of his debts, and he had something left over called profit that he put in the bank. And we called that wealth, and that's the old school. Now today, you know, I hear these people on the television, they say, America is the wealthiest nation in the world, and surely we can afford health care for everyone. I don't know where that guy's from or what he's smoking, but you know, the same news media that guy is parroting that story from is also reporting that America has a budget deficit every year of about $250 to $750 billion. You got two wars going over here that you're spending $100 billion a year on off budget, and you're not even counting it. And you got Social Security and Medicare over here that are upside down. Medicare is consuming $42 billion in deficit for 2006, and it'll double for 2007, and it continues to double until the thing goes upside down. So I'm having a hard time understanding how the United States of America is the richest nation of the world when the United States government is an underwriter for $59 trillion worth of debt and obligations. And now you got a CDO crisis coming up here, and they just pumped in $168 billion in 2 days into the economic system. They pumped in $168 billion in 2 days. Where'd they get it? They just printed it up. Now, boys and girls, that's not wealth. Wealth is cows, sheep, chickens, wheat, corn, beans, honey, oil, big screen TVs, and Nike shoes. That's wealth. I wouldn't deny it. But printing up $168 billion and spending it into society isn't wealth. In fact, it's inflation, and all that does is debilitate or degenerate the value of the dollars you've already got. So when I hear somebody say to me that America's the richest nation in the world, you know, I got to ask the question, you know, what in the hell is that guy smoking? Now, there's another one over here. The question arises, what is it that the government invents? Now, I can remember Henry Ford invented the Ford automobile. Now, if you're a Chevy man, that's no great invention, but if you're a Ford man, you know that's the greatest thing since the Messiah walking on water, isn't it? And then I can remember a guy by the name of Edison. He had 1,200 patents. He invented things like the light bulb. And I flip on my light bulb and I say, you know, that guy Edison did me a big favor. Because if I didn't have this light bulb, I'd have to have a match and strike it and light up my kerosene lantern, and that kerosene lamp wouldn't be near as good a light as this electric light bulb. So I thought Edison did me a pretty good-sized favor. And Robert Fulton invented the steamboat. Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, and I can pick up the telephone, call somebody, and I can get on a boat and travel from here to there. And I thought those inventions were pretty good. So I got to thinking, well, what in the hell has the government invented? Can anybody out there, you know, think of anything, or can you send me an email saying, what has the government invented that's been a benefit to mankind? Now, government invents. I mean, they've got laboratories out here. They've got facilities. They spend billions of dollars a year inventing things. But I can't think of anything that government has invented that's ever benefited me, you, mankind, or anybody else. For instance, it was the government that invented nuclear weapons in the Manhattan Project. Remember that story? And the nuclear weapons are like the genie that got out of the jar. I mean, it's out of the jar, and there's a number of countries around the world now that have nuclear weapons. But I got to ask, how do nuclear weapons benefit anybody? I guess somebody's going to say, well, it's the ultimate weapon of such immense destruction that it is unimaginable to use it. So therefore, we have peace. We have peace. The Bible had a statement in there two or three times that says, when you hear them crying peace, peace, when there's no peace, you'll know war is right around the door or right around the corner. Now, the story that nuclear weapons have brought us peace, you know, I'm not quite sure that I understand the logic behind that. It sounds kind of oxymoronic to me. Between 1945 and 1970, we'd had 40 wars in the world. I don't think nuclear weapons prevented any of those 40 wars in that period of time. From 1970 to the present, I don't know how many wars we've had. I'm not speaking just of the United States. I mean, there's been lots of other people. Like in Rwanda, remember that war down there, civil war, and they killed, I don't know, God only knows how many Watutsis or whatever they were down there. There's been wars and rumors of wars going on all around us over here, and I haven't seen anything that nuclear weapons have prevented. You've got a million people dead over in Darfur, over in Sudan. I don't think the nuclear weapons are doing anything for those people over there. And then our government has given us biological agents. You know, they've got biological agents, you know, germ warfare. Yeah, that's an invention the government gives us, all right, but I'm not really sure that it benefits me. I'm not sure how I can use that feeding my chickens, milking my cows, living my life, buying gasoline, traveling here to Springfield or something. I'm just as soon, you know, if I had anything to say about it, I'd just assume we didn't have those biological weapons. And the other day, I got a laugh. The other day I was watching, I don't know, McNeil Air or somebody over there. Back in 1918, there was a terrible flu epidemic. Now, World War One, during the war, in the hostilities, 4 years of war, killed about 25 million people. God, that's a bunch of people, you know. That's like taking all the people in New York City twice and killing them all in 4 years. Now, that's, you know, that's pretty sobering if you stop and think about it. Well, anyway, in 1918, this disease pathogen comes along. It's called the Spanish flu. Killed 50 million people. Some say it killed up to 100 million because you can't tell how many people it killed, you know, over in Africa and Asia. They don't count very well good over there. You know. But, you know, from the American perspective, the number of people they could count, you know, and identify bodies, you know, they figured 50 million. That's twice as many as World War One. Killed them in about 2 years, 1918, 1919. The other day, they went out and they dug up a body in Alaska that had died. Some guy died, you know, in Alaska, this flu. So they dug up the body and they've got the strain, the strain of flu called Spanish flu that killed this guy in 1918. They've got it in the laboratory now. You've got a disease pathogen here that killed 50 million people around the world, and you go dig up a body so that you can get that disease strain. And they got to have a reason for doing that. I mean, it's got to rank up right up around somewhere around 10 for insanity, you know, from my point of view. And that's like digging up bubonic plague, you know, and passing it around on the school grounds. I mean, when he's right mind, you know, don't want to get close to bubonic plague or Spanish flu. But, you know, and so the guy says, well, the reason that we did this is the Center for Disease Control down in Atlanta, Georgia, staffed by all these people with degrees after their names. He said, well, the reason we're doing this is because, you know, we got this bird flu on the horizon, and we need to understand flu better. And what better flu could you use than one that killed 50 million people? And so we're out here experimenting with it so that we can find a vaccine, so that we can cure and we can prevent the bird flu. Do you hear that? So I listen, you know, I'm polite, I listen. And I discovered the other day, I think I've reported this a time or two, but just for your information in case you didn't know. If every year you go out, you know, like they tell you every year, go get your flu shot. You know, you go out and you get your flu shot every year for 10 years in a row, right? It's just about a guarantee that you will come down with Alzheimer's disease. If you get a flu shot four times in 10 years, your chances of getting the Alzheimer's disease goes up to about 50% or more, or goes up by 50% or more. The thimerosal that's in the vaccine gets into your brain and evidently deranges it in some way. I'm not quite sure how it works, and I'm not sure anybody else knows either, but those are the statistics. So I stay as far away from doctors, hospitals, the CDC, Spanish flu, bird flu, and flu vaccines as I can get. You know, if those were sitting over there somewhere around, you know, Nanking, China, that's just about where I'd like to see them. And I'd like to be over here on this side of the world, just about as far away from that as I can get. I looked at that and I said, I'm talking about oxymorons over here. Now, I guess that makes a lot of sense, you know, if you've been to college. And I guess if you've been educated to think that you're the cure-all for all diseases and that there's a disease problem out there, and what we need to do is dig up bubonic plague, maybe a little Spanish flu, can mix them up in the laboratory over here, and we can come up with a vaccine, start sticking that in people's arms, and we can probably cure some diseases here. Okay, I just thought I'd throw that out there for your consideration. And then we have these chemical weapons. Government is good at inventing F-15 Tomcats, laser-guided bombs, nuclear weapons, biological agents, and chemical weapons. They call these weapons of mass destruction. They got a little acronym for them. They call them WMDs, weapons of mass destruction. You want to know why we're at war in Iraq? It's because of weapons of mass destruction. These weapons of mass destruction that we thought Saddam Hussein had in Iraq proved out later to be he didn't have them. But that was the reason that we went to war over there, is because he had these nuclear weapons, biological agents, and chemical weapons. And so we had to We had to take those away from. What I don't understand is that the Russians have nuclear weapons, biological agents, and chemical weapons. Why don't we go over there to Moscow and take them away from them? The Chinese have nuclear weapons, biological agents, and chemical weapons. I can't understand. I mean, if you're going to go over to Iraq and take them away from those Iraqi people, then why don't we? They must be bad for them. If these weapons are bad for the Iraqi people and the Iraqi government, aren't they just as bad for the Russians and the Russian people and the Russian government and the Chinese government? You know, if you stop and think about it, if nuclear weapons and biological agents and chemical weapons are bad, then why don't we dispose of ours? Now, I know somebody's going to say, well, you fool, you nitwit, we can't dispose of ours because those guys have theirs. Oh, okay. The Russians have nuclear weapons, so we have to have nuclear weapons. One of the things that I noticed is that so far, no, I can't speak for the future, but so far the Russians haven't dropped any nuclear weapons on anybody. And the Chinese, they haven't dropped any nuclear weapons on anybody. The only people in the world that ever dropped a nuclear weapon on somebody else was the gum-chewing, camera-toting American that sees himself as the savior of mankind. Now, you know, somebody said to me, you can't trust Saddam Hussein with nuclear weapons. Excuse me, Saddam never dropped a nuclear weapon on anybody. And he's not that I know of. And the Americans have. And the Americans are talking about tactical nuclear strikes against Iran right now. I thought, you know, being an old timer, I thought that the only way, that's what they used to tell us when I was a kid in school, the only way that America would ever use nuclear weapons is in retaliation. That's not what we're talking about now. We're talking about preemptive strikes against Iran with nuclear weapons. And I'm sitting here going, okay, don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. Bible prophecy has a little something to say about nuclear weapons. There's three places, Matthew 24, Micah 5, and Ezekiel 6. There's nuclear war coming. And nuclear war is coming to a city near you shortly. But I don't think we're going to like that. So when I hear government agents that just want to help, I can't think about anything the government has invented that has benefited mankind. Let's just take a look at education. Government is involved in education like you just can't believe. You know, we're spending $500 billion a year in taxes. That's a half a trillion, you know, $500 billion. That's, you know, as old Everett Dirksen used to say, you know, a billion here and a billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about some real money. That's $500 billion a year on education, and they graduate 2,000 high school seniors a year in the United States of America that cannot read their diplomas. It used to be when I was a kid in school, if you couldn't read, you couldn't graduate. And that's what made your high school diploma of some value. Because if you didn't have a high school diploma, then we would say, well, you probably can't read. If you did have a high school diploma, we would say, well, you probably can read. Today, we graduate 2,000 a year with high school diplomas who cannot read. So can you tell me of what value is a high school diploma? So Johnny can't read, and we graduate him from high school with a diploma that says he's educated. Now, I thought that when people were illiterate, they were uneducated. I guess I was out of touch with reality. But I think that's an oxymoron. Now, there's another one over here. It's called the War on Cancer. President Nixon came up with that idea, War on Cancer. This is back in the 1970s, I believe it was, late 60s, early 70s. And he said, you know, we got this cancer problem, and we need to solve that. So he declared a war on cancer and then earmarked $2 billion a year for cancer research. Now, let's go back to about 1970, 1980, 1990, 2000. 2000. That's over 30 years ago, isn't it? All right, well, back in 1970, when President Nixon said, we got this war on cancer, cancer affected, that is, one person out of every four would get cancer in his lifetime. In 1950, when I was a wee shaver, it was one in five. In 1900, it was one in 33. Now, let's take a look at this for a minute, because 1900, without any war on cancer, hell, without even a medical practitioner out here that even could diagnose cancer, 1900, one person in 33 could expect to get cancer in his lifetime. By 1950, it was one in five. By 1970, it was one in four. Today, it's one out of two, one out of every two people. What that means is here in America, with 300 million people, 150 million people can expect to get cancer within their lifetime. By the year 2020, they expect one out of one. They expect that everybody in America will get cancer in his lifetime at least once by the year 2020. Now, we've got this war on cancer, and we're spending money finding a cancer cure. Now, we can find the secret to nuclear weapons, biological agents, and chemical weapons. We're spending billions to find the cure to cancer. Have been for many years. I can tell you right now, you'll never find a cure to cancer. It's a $500 billion a year industry. If you found a cure to cancer tomorrow morning, the economy would collapse the next day. You can't have a cure to cancer. It's too big a percentage of the national income, the gross domestic product. The economy would collapse without cancer. 16% of everything that we spend goes to medicine, and about half of what goes to medicine, which would be about 8% of the gross domestic product, goes to cancer. I just thought I'd throw that out there for your consideration. So Yeah, it's true. We Americans are inventive people, and I'm not sure that we're inventing the things that we really need, could use, and that make life better. I can't think of any real useful government intervention in education that has done us any good. It used to be that in America, when children went to school, they could, when they got out of the process, read, write, and count. They can't today. There was a time in America when we had a little bit of cancer, but today it's a raging pandemic. I mean, it's worldwide. And when we talk about the government can solve all of our problems, can you tell me anything that government has taken on, any problem that government has taken on that they have solved and put to bed? Would you send me an email and tell me? Tell me about these great successes. Because we Americans believe in government like we believe in baptism, the Holy Ghost, and the rapture. And I've been racking my brain over here trying to figure out something. The other day, I was watching the TV. Remember, we were talking about this thing of a national health care insurance. You're going to have a national health care program. Hell, they got that in England, Russia, China. In Canada, when somebody gets real sick, you know, and they need real serious medical attention, they come to the United States. I can't think of anything about the Canadian social services system up there that would be worth emulating here in the United States, but for some reason they want to do that. I don't really care. I'm not concerned about it. I mean, if you want socialized medicine here in America, you're going to get after it. But leave me out, would you? Don't give me health care insurance. Stay the hell away from me. I want to get as far away from you as I can get. But I don't want to get in the way of the happiness and success of other people, but I just thought I'd point that out. It sounded like it was kind of an oxymoron to me. It hasn't worked in the places where it's been tried, but if we do it here, it'll solve all of our healthcare problems. That's the definition of insanity, wasn't it? Where you do the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. I don't know. It's beyond me. I just want to give up on that one. I got to tell you a little story here, but I got to tell you after we come back, I got to give you a reminder here at the halfway point that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then just go to the website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. We teach 8 schools here at the law school, 8 subjects. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement with no government subsidies whatsoever. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed to the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, and they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the law or an editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about oxymorons. You know, the sharpest marble in the drawer, or cruel kindness, things like that. I'm from the government, and I'm here to help. That's a real oxymoron. I used to run a company out in Boise, Idaho, and we had a paint booth. And our paint booth was perfectly satisfactory. And the people who worked in our paint booth thought it was great, and they didn't have any complaints whatsoever. And the two men that worked in the paint booth were both skilled, professional, experienced painters. I mean, these were guys that actually painted. These are the guys that actually took the paint out of the cans, put it into the paint gun, and pulled the trigger and put the paint on the product. These guys had been doing this for many, many years, and they were perfectly satisfied with it. Well, one day, an OSHA inspector came into our factory, and he took a look at our spray booth, and he says, "Oh, my God, this will never do. This has to be changed. This has to be rebuilt." Now, you know, I'm just a pretty pragmatic guy. I asked the guys that were in the paint booth, I said, "Is there anything here in this paint booth that needs to be changed? See, I'm a businessman." And I've got a guy working for me, and he comes to me and he says, "This is substandard. This is a bad practice. This thing over here gets in the way of production. It's harmful to my health, and I don't like it." And you see, as a businessman, I want to make money. I mean, I don't deny it. I'm just here to make money. And if I have an employee comes over and says, "You know, this stuff gets in my lungs, and this stuff makes me feel real bad," it doesn't take a real smart guy. I mean, you don't have to have a degree after your name to figure out that guy probably isn't working to the maximum of his capacity. He probably isn't turning out as much product as he could if he felt better. If you want to test it, you know, take a hammer and smash your thumb and then go to work and see how much you produce. People who hurt, people who don't feel good, people who are sick do not produce very much product. Now, I'm not a doctor, and I'm not a sociologist, and I'm not a genius, but I'm not brain dead. I could figure that out all by myself. So I asked my employees, I said, is there anything in the spray booth that you need, that you want, that you desire? And they said, no, it's perfectly satisfactory. And I wasn't disappointed with their production. They were producing, lots and lots of boards with paint on it. And I thought they were doing real well, and I was paying them, and we were making a profit. But the OSHA man came in, and he saw fault. He said, this is substandard. He said, this is bad for their health. It's bad for everything. It's just bad, 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 and you got to fix this. So I told him, go to hell. So we had some. We had some tussles and go-arounds there with the OSHA people there for a while. We did a couple of court cases. So some time went by, and the OSHA people, they just kept raising hell with us, and so I just kept raising hell with them. But in business, we're not in business because we want to fight with the government, because we want to spend a lot of time in court, and we want to spend a lot of money on lawyers and prove, points like blacks can ride the front of the bus and things like that. Businessmen aren't interested in that. We don't care where blacks ride on the bus. Doesn't even come up on the radar screen. So we're not trying to prove any points, and I had a lot of stockholders, business associates. And so they prevailed upon me, and they said, go fix the spray booth to the OSHA standards. And the reason I didn't want to do it is because the estimated cost, I think, was $8,000 at the time. So it was $8,000, and I didn't want to spend $8,000 doing something that didn't need doing. I had an old-timey philosophy, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That's kind of an old-timey, backward, archaic philosophy. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, anyway, I said, okay, we'll spend the money, we'll fix it. So the OSHA guy came in, and he beat us down. He's satisfied now because he whipped us. And so the OSHA guy, he comes up with this plan, and we drew up the plans, and he approved them. And so we fixed the spray booth to the OSHA standards, whatever those standards were. I forget the darn name. We spent the money, and we put in the big fan, and we did all these thingies over here that they wanted. And when we got all through, the OSHA guy comes in, he puts a stamp of approval on it, smiled real broadly. And he left, and so we went to work, and I kind of put it out of my mind, and we were painting boards and doing our thing. And one day, the EPA man came in. And so the EPA man, he's doing his tour, and he comes up to the spray booth, and he says, oh, my God, this will never do. This has got to be fixed. And so I tried to be as calm as I could, and I reminded him. I said, now, this is a brand-new spray booth. this is state-of-the-art. This is the greatest thing since, the invention of paint, or lead for paint or something. And I said, besides that, it was just approved by OSHA. And he said, I don't care. OSHA doesn't have any jurisdiction over paint. This is a chemical hazard. This is an environmental hazard over it. So he did his thing over here, and he came to the conclusion that this thing was bad, and he wrote me up, and he fined me, and he did all these thingies over here, and I didn't pay the fines, and so pretty soon this thing develops into litigation. And the OSHA people, I don't know how much money they spent, but they had a van out on the railroad siding about 3 blocks away. And when this thing finally came up for trial, it was in state court, and they had charged us for violating the environmental laws, or the air pollution standards of Idaho, in Title 19, Section 4112, I believe it was. No, 412. 412. 19412, that's what it was. And so they presented their case first. Of course, the prosecution goes first. And they came in, and they brought in their expert witnesses, and they had two guys, 24 hours a day, two guys in a van, 24 hours a day for 3 weeks. Out there on our siding, and they were monitoring the air, and they were taking air samples for air quality. And I was really impressed. I got to tell you, your government, they really do their homework. I mean, they really do a good job. They could identify Glidden paint by its lot number, 4112 or 5660. They could identify Dutch Boy paint from Glidden paint, from Sherwin-Williams paint. Those are the three paint companies that we use. And they could tell you the lot and the batch number. They could tell you whether you were using paint, lacquer, or lacquer or varnish. They could tell you what time of day that you were using it. They could tell you how many parts per million was in the air. I mean, they delivered a report that would just stagger you. I was sitting there with my mouth open. I said, oh, my God, how'd these people figure this out? And it came out, they had a van down there. Now, I estimated that they spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $30,000 to put this case together against us. Now, keep this in mind. First of all, the employees who are experienced painters working in our paint department never had a complaint. They never went to OSHA or the EPA and said, this guy Gordon's trying to kill us. He's got a substandard spray booth and we need protection. No, it wasn't my employees. It was the OSHA inspector on a random inspection. And he decided that the paint booth was substandard and prevailed upon us. And God knows how many hours and how much time and how much money they spent to browbeat us and beat us into submission and get us to spend the $8,000 and rebuild our paint booth. Then here comes the OSHA guys, the EPA guys, and they spent about $30,000. The nearest we could figure, just figuring that these guys were getting somewhere around prevailing wages and spent 24 hours a day with two guys in a van for 30 days and then put this case together and presented it in trial and so they got all through with that, and they made the presentation. Great presentation. wonderful presentation. I mean, they came in with names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence. They did a hell of a job. You got to give credit. You know where credit's due. Well, anyway, they lost the case, and they lost the case because they were using the California standards. See, the EPA standards in Idaho had never been enacted by our legislature, so we did a little legal research. And we discovered that all of the statutes in Title 19 from 400 through 450, I believe it was, had been reserved, and they charged us with a violation of Idaho Code 19412, which had been reserved, which means that there is no law in Idaho. Now, if we had done that in Truckee, Idaho, I mean, I'd still be in prison. If we had done those things that we were doing in Idaho in California, we'd probably never see the light of day. I mean, they just throw us into Guantanamo, and that'd be the end of it. But fortunately, they hadn't done that in Idaho, and so they lost the case, and it was dismissed, and we went about our business. Now, the reason I brought this story to you is because, you see, this is these government agents, the EPA, you know, the OSHA people, all of these people have been to college. They've all got degrees after their name. These people are educated. They read, they write, they can count, you know, without taking their shoes off. And they come out to a businessman like myself, and then they impose themselves upon us under color of law to do things that we really don't want to do in a free society, you know, like the United States of America, the land of the free and home of the brave. And that's why I think that that land of the free and home of the brave is an oxymoron. And hello, I'm from the government, and I'm here to help, is BS, an oxymoron to the nth degree. Now, in addition to that, my conclusion was, I'm going to tell you another story, but my conclusion is these government officials, you know, they stand around the water cooler figuring out how they can impair production in the private sector. I would have thought that the purpose for government and the bureaucracy is to help production and to help simplify or to help the production of goods and services in the country so that the gross domestic product would grow, so that everybody would have more wealth, that everybody would have better jobs, and that they would have more disposable income so that they could buy more big screen TVs and more Nike tennis shoes from China. That's what I thought. That's not true. That's not their function. That's not their purpose. They're not there to facilitate production and wealth. They are there to decrease wealth, to impede production, to destroy the economy, to bring upon us poverty. Well, you know, just from my experience, you know, I'm just Joe Sixpack over here. Now, let me tell you a little story over here. I had a guy one time call me from Washington, D.C., and he said that he wanted to conduct an audit of our employment records. Now, listen, this isn't the local guy up on Idaho Street. This isn't the state of Idaho that says, we want to audit your books and see if you've been cheating on your payroll deductions and you haven't been paying all of your Social Security taxes for your employees or your unemployment taxes, you know, for your employees. No, no, this guy's from Washington, D.C., 3,000 miles away, calls me on the telephone, says, we want to do an audit. And I asked him, I said, you want to do an audit? What kind of an audit? He said, I want to audit your payroll records. I said, what does the federal government have to do with our payroll records? And he says, well, you know that unemployment tax you pay? I said, yeah. He said, well, you pay 3.5% unemployment tax. I said, yeah, yeah. See, I'm just a little company, and I had to pay the maximum. I was paying the maximum tax, 3.5%. And he said, okay, well, you know that 0.5%? That's the federal unemployment tax. You pay 3% to the state and 0.5% to the federal government. And that's what I want to audit, that 0.5%. Now, boys and girls, I've got 30 employees. My payroll is $10,000 a week. That's about $500,000 a year. So let's just take $500,000. Okay, $500,000 in payroll. And let's multiply that times 0.005. It's $2,500 a year. So my little company pays $2,500 a year in unemployment taxes to the United States of America in far, far off Washington, D.C. Now, here's a bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. says, I'm going to get on an airplane, and I'm going to fly from Washington out to Boise, Idaho, and I'm going to spend a week or 10 days auditing your books for the last 3 years. And I look at that, and I said, if I was Boise Cascade, and I had 10,000 employees, and maybe I was putting out, you know, $50 million a year, and we're talking about, you know, $2, $3 million, I could see a guy coming out from Washington to audit the books of a company to see whether or not we had cheated the government out of $2 or $3 million. But $2,500, I thought that was a little bizarre. So anyway, you know, far be it for me to get in the way of government, you know, in their duties and so on. But I want you people to understand that all we're talking about here is $2,500. So the worst I could have done was to stiff him for $2,500. Now, what do you think it cost this guy? What do you think it cost the government to send a guy from Washington, D.C., put him on United Airlines? I don't know if he's flying coach or first class. But in those days, it would cost you about $500-$800 for round-trip ticket, you know, from Washington to Boise back to Washington. Now, he's going to stay here for a week or 10 days. As it turned out, he was there 10 days. Now, what does it cost to pay the wages of a government bureaucrat for 10 days in Boise, Idaho, staying down at the Ramada Inn? Well, you know, we got to thinking about that, and I kind of figured, you know, with his expense account and with his room and board and with the hotel and with his airfare and with his wages, that it probably was somewhere around $5,000, maybe $10,000. And I said, why would the government want to spend $5,000 or $10,000 to find out whether I stiffed him for $2,500? Now, I didn't stiff him for anything. I mean, I paid all my taxes. But anyway, so he shows up and he announced something to me that was really surprising. He said to me, he said, "You have to furnish me with an office." And I looked at this guy like he was Mort from work. And I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, the law requires that you furnish me with an office and a telephone. You know, I'm just a little company out here with 30 employees. We have 32,000 square feet of factory. we're not talking about General Electric, you know. We're not talking about General Motors. We're talking about the Blandis Manufacturing Company." Well, we had three offices. We had my secretary's office. Now, she's absolutely indispensable. I can't take my secretary and put her out in the street somewhere to do the payroll and accounts receivable and accounts payable. And, you know, I mean, you know, there's some people in the company that are indispensable. So we decided, well, we can't take Candy's office. So then I thought about, well, how about my plant manager? You know, the guy that runs the day-to-day operations, we could take his office. But if I did that, how in the hell am I going to run my company? So we figured, well, he's kind of indispensable. So the only other office left is mine. Yeah, you guessed it. Yeah, the owner of the company, he's not that important. So they kicked me out of my office. And we gave it to the government bureaucrat. So here's this government bureaucrat. Now he's sitting in my chair, drinking my coffee, and using my telephone that I should be using over here, calling my customers and making sales for the future so that I could make more sales, so that I could take more orders and produce more product and employ more people and make more money and pay more payroll and pay more payroll taxes. You know, that was my job in the operation. I was kind of the chief cook and janitor and bottle washer and salesman. So he works in here for a couple of weeks, you know, 10 days. It's Monday through Friday, and then Monday through Friday. On the last Friday, he comes to me and he says, "Okay, I'm through with my audit." And he says, "I've discovered some indiscrepancies here." He says, "See, you have cheated your employees over the past 3 years out of $10,000. And I'm going to write up an order, and you have 90 days to pay this $10,000 to your employees that you have cheated out of their overtime. You have cheated your employees out of $10,000 in overtime over the past 3 years." And I said to the guy, I said, Well, I didn't know that. What are you talking about? What is it that you're complaining about? What did I do? So, well, here's a time card. Let's look at this time card. He said, "This time card says 7:46 a.m. Yeah. And look at here. He punched out at the end of the day at 4:37 p.m. I said, "Yeah. Okay." I said, "Now, this guy punches in 10 or 12 minutes before 8, and he punches out 6 or 7 minutes after 4:30. He has more than 8 hours on his time card. Therefore, you did not pay him for that 15 minutes that he has on his time card, or 20 minutes. And he said, "All of your employees are that way." I said, "Oh, okay. Let me explain this to you, sir. You see, our time clock is down here at the front door where the workmen come in. And the time cards are up here in this rack, here at the time clock, which is right outside my secretary's door, so that we can monitor the time clock and we can see that it isn't being tampered with by employees or others. And then the employee takes his time card and he punches in, and he usually comes a little bit before 8 in the morning. All right, now he's punched in and he puts his time card back in the slot, and he goes upstairs on the third floor where we have the locker room, and he puts his lunch bucket in his locker, and then he puts on his work clothes, typically his coveralls for his workstation and one thing and another. He smokes a cigarette, and then he waits until the bell rings, and at 8 o'clock the bell rings. And then he gets up there in the locker room, and he walks to his workstation, which takes him 2 or 3 minutes. And then he begins work until 10 o'clock. And then we have coffee break. That's 15 minutes. And then he goes back to work at 10:15. And then he works until noon, and the bell rings. And then he goes up to the locker room, or he gets his lunch bucket, and he eats his lunch. And at 12:30, the bell rings. And then he goes back to work until 2 o'clock or 2:30. And then the bell rings, and he takes his afternoon coffee break. And then he goes back to work. And then at 4:30, the bell rings. And then he leaves his workstation. He goes back up to the locker room. And then he smokes a cigarette and chews the rag with the boys, changes his clothes, picks up his lunch bucket. He walks out the front door. And on the way out, he punches out. When we have overtime, we give him a separate time card. And then he comes down and he punches his overtime on the separate time card, and we pay him the time and a half. This is his regular time card. And if you'll notice in the box that there are time cards that are plainly marked overtime, and those are all paid. And he said, "Yes, I saw those. I saw them." But Mr. Gordon, you don't understand. He said, "You see, the law says that you have to pay overtime for every minute over 8 hours, and these time cards all have more than 8 hours on them. Therefore, you have to pay time and a half for these 10 or 15 minutes on every time card for the last 3 years. And if you don't do that, we are going to fine you an additional $10,000. You getting the drift here, boys and girls? Now, my experience has been with government agents. Unlike the mafia, when the mafia comes to you, they walk in your store and they say, "You need protection." And you say, "Why do I need protection?" And he says, "Because if you don't pay me $100 a week protection, your store is going to burn down." And I say, why is my store going to burn down? And he said, because you didn't pay protection. You see the cleaning establishment down the street? It burned down last week. He didn't pay protection, and he had a fire. And Mr. Gordon, if you don't pay protection, you're going to have a fire. So seeing the logic in this argument, you give the guy $100. He walks out, and you don't see him again. Every week he comes into the store, you reach in the cash register, you hand him $100, he walks out and you don't see him again. Cost you $5,200 a year, but he doesn't get in the way of production. He doesn't impede your business. He doesn't mess with your customers. He just takes his protection money and he goes his way. Government agents are different. Government agents not only come in and take your money, but they get in the way. They haul you into court and make you defend your spray booth that none of your employees are complaining about. They spend four times more than the subject matter at issue, the $2,500 in taxes I pay. They spend $10,000 and come in here and threaten you with fines, and they want you to pay $10,000 to employees that the employees never complained about. Not one of my employees ever said, Mr. Gordon, you're cheating me out of 15 minutes of overtime every day. Not one of my employees ever called Washington or the local Department of Labor and said, this guy Gordon has an unfair labor practice, he's cheating us. I've had thousands of employees in my lifetime. Never one employee ever complained to anybody, me, the government, or anybody, never said George Gordon cheated him out of a dime. Well, not until the government agent walked in the door. No. I would rather do business with the mafia. Because when you pay the mafia, they get the hell out of your way and let you go to work and make money so that you can pay more protection. The government works just exactly the opposite. They not only come in and get in your way, they not only come in and demand money and protection money, but they get in the way and impair your production so that you can't make the money that you need to pay on the protection that they're demanding. And I say, that is an oxymoron. Well, all right, boys and girls, we're out of time. I got to tell you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. And if you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.